Hi, everybody. My name's Carla, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really, really delighted to be here with you guys this weekend. And I want to thank my friend Karen for the invitation. And it's good to see my friend Terry. And thanks to Mark, my partner, yesterday morning. I swear to God, we were having breakfast, and you know, Jack C's on the schedule to do the Al-Anon portion, and we were scheduled to do a workshop yesterday morning, and I turned to Mark at breakfast and said, "So you're going to be my partner instead?" And he says, "What?" You know, and just did a wonderful job, and then I just loved your talk today too. Thank you. And to be here with you all and to hear Terry last night. I haven't heard you in a long time, and it's just good. And I'm really looking forward to hearing Jerry tomorrow, so I hope everybody stays for that. And thanks to my friends who did the workshops. And thanks to the committee for all your hard work. These things don't put themselves together. Really, really nice. Wow. Everywhere you go, you feel at home. And thank you, Margo, for picking me up at the airport and taking me tomorrow in advance and just making sure everybody's okay. You know, it's nice. And I know what it feels like, too. I like having a job. You know, jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life in the beginning, especially. You know, they taught me that when I'm thinking about you, I'm not thinking about me for just a minute at least. And for a few minutes, I get to experience the lack of the noise on the inside of my own head. You know, I got to think about something else for a little while. And after a while, that gets good. You know, I'm going to do that some more. And so thank you all for that. But in the meantime, because you guys did that, we all benefit from it. And the staff at the hotel, wow, it's really nice. You know, a great job. I know probably they're not anywhere around here, but thanks to them, because it's going pretty smoothly. And Mark, you know, for like not losing the plot, you know. there's no number two. And we just go on anyway. So I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I used to think it was very important to try to figure that out. Was it my crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family? If you had my family, you'd drink too, you know? And then I found out that that gave me an inventory, but it didn't make me alcoholic. And the reason I more and more sure I get about that, because I started meeting people like my husband, who some of you have met. My husband, Doug, says hello to those of you who know him. And he's not traveling anymore, but he sends his best. But I meet people like him, you know, lived a charmed childhood. You know, he was one boy, had three sisters. They grew up loving each other and helping each other. Stuff like happened in their lives sometimes bad stuff, and they gather together and support each other. And, you know, still, after we have a family event, I come away with a little bit of a sugar headache, you know what I mean? Because it's just so sweet, you know? And yet, he sits right next to me in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why? Because alcohol did exactly foreign to him what it did foreign to me. And I personally think the best description of alcoholism is on page 44 in our big book. Yes, the doctor's opinion breaks it all down, but one paragraph, man, sums it all up. After all those pages, all the way up through 43, and I'm a page quoter, just so you'll know if I misquote it, you can read your own big book and find out. Have a big old discussion about that speaker on Saturday night, how, yeah, wrong page. But page 44, if when you honestly want to find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. Boom, problem. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. Boom, answer. Oh. And, and then there's a lot to be said about it, because clearly, my sobriety date, September 25th, 1987, and I'm still here. So and we're all still talking about it. But I'm glad I know. You know, it wasn't like I didn't believe in a God or have any spiritual experiences. I had a relationship with a power greater than myself when I was a small child. I felt it. I knew it in my gut. It was there. all, you know, our book says deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. In the last analysis, it's only there he may be found. And, you know, like I said, I felt that when I was a small child, but when alcohol came along, and as I started to discover what it would do for me, man, why do all the work when I could just take a drink? I can say a prayer, but a drink is so much quicker, you know? Like, and it took over. It took over and became the big interceder, the big interrupter. I didn't know. It felt like it was interceding. Counterfeit. And stuff was happening in my life at home, and I left home at an early age, and I still believe it was for me to leave home. Even though I jumped from the frying pan into the fire for a while, it was for me to do that. But as alcohol took over, I mean, it became my spirituality. It was a great substitute for spirituality. It became my growing up muscle. Why do the work when a drink makes me feel like I'm doing it anyway? And became the thing that made me feel buffered from you and the thing that made me feel connected to you all at the same time. Why wouldn't I drink that? And that feeling only happens to about 10% of the population. You know, a lot of people, I still get entertained by non-alcoholic drinking. I don't call them normies, because I think we have a lot more in common than we do, you know, not in common with non-alcoholics, except for the way they drink, you know. And I'll tell you, you take a non-alcoholic and an alcoholic walk up to the door of a party, and the host answers the door and says, you know what, I'm really sorry, but we just ran out of booze. Fear down the spine of every alcoholic. Right? Do I have some in my purse? Do I have some in my trunk? Where's the store? Can I get there? What's happening? You know, and the non-alcoholic walks in and says, okay, let's dance. You know, they don't care. They don't even care that there's no alcohol. You know, and I've seen it over and over and over. Non-alcoholic drinking is very entertaining to me. I don't do it that way. And it's not like, here's the thing. It's not like I always set out to get drunk. I know if you're anything like me, when we first come in, it's like we're full of ego. I never wanted just two drinks. I always like to get insanely drunk. But for me, it wasn't true. Not always. At the end, you know, I just wanted to have a couple of drinks and get my stuff done. I wanted to have a couple of drinks and go to work so I could take care of my daughter. I wanted to have a couple of drinks and keep my stuff straight, right? Just a couple. Like I saw so many people be able to do. Just a couple and go back to work. You know, not like I didn't set out to get drunk a lot of times. I could certainly do that and succeed. Non-alcoholics can do that too. But it was at times that I didn't wanna. I just wanted a couple and then move on. Just get there and move on. Couldn't. And so, like I said, I left home, and I got to tell you some background why I'm here and what happened, what the circumstances look like, although after a while we find out that it's not circumstances, is it? Because once I got sober and I found this program and really, really began to trust it, what I find is that there's no circumstance in the world that can make me drink, under no circumstance. My circumstances don't dictate my peace of mind. My attitude does. It's been said over and over and over this weekend. But before, I couldn't have done it. Before I got sober, before I came to AA, I had to come to AA. And we don't have the corner or the market cornered on spiritual experiences or sobriety even, but I needed this particular miracle. I needed this one. It's the one, it's the portal through which I came so that I could stand on my feet and then become part of the world at large again, but still tethered to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started leaving home, and by the time I was 14, I found myself in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area, where a couple of guys offered me money for sex, and I said yes and did the next indicated thing, and boom, a whole new career path opened up for me. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And Dr. Silkworth talked about us in that way. After a time, our alcoholic lives seem the only normal one. We can't differentiate the true from the false. It seemed like, you know, and I'm not against sex. I'm not even against sex for money if that's your deal and it's working for you. You know, I mean, that's the whole thing. Is that working for you? But the deal was I was 14, and it wasn't my choice. It wasn't on my list of things I wanted to be when I grew up. If you had asked me a couple of years earlier, I would have told you I wanted to be the first woman to run a 4-minute mile and the first woman Major League Baseball player and the first woman president. I had big dreams. and my life took a wide left turn with my new solution. And I ended up in a mental hospital for about a year. I was supposed to be there for 2 weeks, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of made myself at home and moved in. And they weren't talking to me a lot about alcoholism. They were talking to me about disorders. I was a very disordered-looking child, alternately violent and withdrawn, and living with a level of frustration down in my gut I did not know how to talk about. In fact, it wasn't until I got to AA, you know, almost 15 years later, that I heard a tape of who I now know was Cubby Selby talking about feeling like a scream looking for a mouth. And I thought, oh, my God, you know. And, you know, you got to get busy in the nut house. You can't just sit around. They were giving me daily nutritional supplements, Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane Sleepers. I suppose they were concerned I wouldn't sleep, and I had become intimately familiar with five-point restraints, and that's what I look like at 15. And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. One of my favorite ways to be busy was the boys back then. I loved all the boys, but my favorites were those sexy, smoldering types, you know. You know the kind. They just sit back there and simmer, and you just never really knew when they were going to blow. And I love those guys. Guys from YA and, you know, other juvenile halls and stuff. I know we got some of those guys in here tonight because I can see the smoke curling up from the corners. I see you. I know you're here. But the trouble with those guys is that they're usually in on, you know, trying to avoid some kind of sentence. So they're in the nut house for a little while, and they got no tools, so they blow. They eventually, you know, they blow. And like my first boyfriend in the nut house, he ended up blowing up and throwing a big chair through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. And my next boyfriend ended up throwing a nurse through the big plate glass window of the boys' unit. So that was progressive too. And I don't know about you, but I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life, you know, music playing in the background of all this drama going on, right? You know, sometimes like you got Patsy Cline in the background. Oh. Some days a mariachi band just with a little fiesta, you know, just some days just flat out rock and roll, right? Just woo. And this particular afternoon in the nut house, I was sitting outside on the smoke break bench having my smoking my tragic cigarettes, watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's the one who threw the chair through the window, or the nurse through the window, and he's off, he's gone, I'm never going to see him again. And I'm devastated, you know, because, like, it was a real relationship, 2-3 weeks or something, and, you know, and nut house love is pretty intense, I got to tell you. And off he goes, and I'm smoking my tragic cigarettes and channeling Greta Garbo and want to be alone. And I hear in the background from the music room, Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch me in the morning, then just walk away." And now I'm dating myself. I know some of you remember that song, but, you know, when will I see you again? Oh. You know, and just dig down deeper. And I love that the book, you know, he speaks right to this. We avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery. You know that? We learn to catch on that where we were doing that, and we go, whoops, nope, we're not going to entertain that anymore. We turn left, right? I didn't know that back then. And so just digging down deep into the self-pity where it feels so good. And I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to the unit where they put the patients they just don't know what to do with anymore. And during the night, one of the night staff invited himself into my room, and when I tried to tell somebody about it, they wouldn't believe me because I'd just, you know, been a jerk the whole time I had been there, so why believe me? And so my boyfriend, who had been discharged just a couple of weeks before, I told him, and he waited on the other side of the fence for me to crawl up the chimney and over the fence and drop down onto the sidewalk the next day and get into his car and drive away. And I always find it entertaining that I had a boyfriend who would wait on the other side of the nut house wall, wait for his girlfriend to climb up the chimney, over the fence, drop down onto the sidewalk and hop in his car so we could drive off into happy destiny. And we lasted 2 weeks, and I was coming off Thorazine. He introduced me to cocaine, and I think it was just too much of a contrast for him. I needed a drink, you know, and Oddly enough, my probation officer knew exactly where to find me and hurt my feelings to find out he'd called her. And she's right here. Come and get her. And on it went, into juvenile hall and into a rehab. The rehab I was in, this is a dating myself again, in the state hospital there at Norwalk, Mark probably knows, in Norwalk. And they were, at the time, Synanon was very popular. And so they had this adolescent unit that was based on Synanon, and there was an adult unit based on Synanon as well, and called the family. And anyway, we had to wear signs and stuff, and all of that stuff. My first sign was, "No, it all starts again." And then there was, "I think I'm tough, but I'm only a cream puff." And yeah, so I lasted like 6 months. And I never went out the front door of any of these places, juvenile hall and then a girl's home, and out the window and down the second story, down a tree and into my friend's truck and, you know, off to Oregon where maybe God is, you know. And I learned to meditate and when I was 17. I have always been a spiritual seeker, always. And yet the more that I would drink, trying to access that spirit, that power greater than myself, the more I interrupted any of that process at all. It was the very thing that was blocking me. And then I got sober, and then it was just me blocking me. But we got a program for that, right? And it took a while. It took a while because it can't be. My mom had a very deep relationship with alcohol and prescription drugs, and for the longest time. And I thought, that's not going to happen to me. It's not going to happen to me. It can't be alcohol. It can't be the alcohol. And so off into happy destiny. We ended up in Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, and more and more I'm developing this relationship with alcohol. I'm free of being locked up. I'm thinking that now that I'm 18 or almost 18, that everything's going to be different now. And, you know, went back to Hollywood for just a short time and ended up, first night, spread eagle on the trunk of an unmarked car, swearing I just thought he wanted directions. And on my way to jail, I have just started to remember again how good it feels not to be under threat or pursuit of the police, not feeling like they're going to show up any second and I'm going to do some time, you know. I get a speeding ticket and I swear I know I deserve every one I get, you know, and then some. But so I'm okay. Here's my license. And I have one. License, registration, all of that, all at one time. You know, that's good. Newcomers, stick around. You can do it too. And then I hooked up with my boyfriend and we rode off into happy destiny. And, you know, I've always been kind of a hippie gypsy heart, you know, and loving that peace and love. I'm a kid who grew up in the 60s. And those people, you know, they didn't take crap. They stood up and marched, right? They said no. They marched. They played that beautiful, peaceful, loving music. And they talked about peace and love and all of that stuff. And I just kept ending up in these violent, horrible relationships. Every single time, there we were. And me and this guy, we ended up beating each other up and down the California coast and pitching a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon and lived there till the rains came and then found this old log cabin that was all beat up on BLM land just north of Grants Pass. I know some of you know where that is. And way up on top of a mountain outside of Merlin. And it's starting to get populated a little bit out there, but back then there was nothing. And the cabin had no roof, so we threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight, and then the baby came. And I thought having this little girl was going to change the way I drank. I'd had enough therapy to know that you got to break the cycle. You got to be a different parent than the one you had. You got to turn it around, you know. And we're drinking homemade wine and moonshine because it was organic and much better for you. Still no change, you know, and by that time I'm getting my clothes and shoes and the necessities of life out of a box behind a store in town, and I think I'm going to be a better parent than the one I had, because I was delusional. And my daughter got in the way of one of our fights when she was about 10 months old, and I had to take her up the road where it's got to be better somewhere else. I always felt like if I just kept moving, hope was just up the road. Like, you can't hit a moving target, right? Sooner or later, I'm going to land, and it's still about the circumstance, And I drug that kid over three states. And My first legitimate work was in the bar business, and it never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have that job? It just seemed to me to be cosmically efficient, you know, and still I think I'm making it just up there, just almost there. And my daughter and I moved down to Southern California, and I was renting a room from my aunt in a little town called Covina, and my daughter was almost 4 years old, and every afternoon I'd gotten this great job in Hollywood, tending bar, not a bad place to work. Everybody, great job, great boss, great people. You know, it wasn't a dive, it was a great place, great money. Any healthy person could have made a great living doing what I was doing, but it's me, I'm the common denominator, right? So every afternoon I'd kiss my daughter goodbye and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood and I'd get thirsty on the way, so I'd stop at the bar on the way to the bar. Who doesn't do that? Have my shots of Cuervo Gold and Bud Backs. Two shots of gold, two Bud Backs. That makes two drinks in alcoholic math. Get up off the bar stool and head off to Hollywood and go do my shift till the wee hours of the morning and crawl back home and start all over again. And I did that like clockwork for months until one afternoon I kissed my girl goodbye like I had been doing. Got in the car, headed out to Hollywood, got thirsty on the way, stopped at the bar on the way to the bar, ordered up those same shots of gold and same Bud Backs, and to this day, I don't know what was different on that day from the day before except for 24 hours, because I didn't hate the job I was going to, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I sat on the bar stool that day and I drank those drinks, and this time I couldn't stop. This time I couldn't stop long enough to get up and go take care of business at the bar that I liked going to. There was no drama or trauma going on that day. I wasn't unhappy with it. I loved that job. I loved the money it brought so I could take care of the most important person in the world, I would have told you, my daughter. I think my favorite story in the Big Book is Fred the accountant, right? Because he says, what does he say? Not a cloud on the horizon, you know? Maybe I'll just go into the bar and have a highball. Business was great for him. He wasn't having any trouble. But he said, maybe if I have a highball, maybe if I call it a highball, it'll be okay. And he goes in and he starts to drink and his life starts to run out of his sleeve like water. Same with me that afternoon, same drinks, same job, nothing's changed. This day I can't stop. The notion that I needed to get up and go to a job I really love so I could take care of the most important person in the world just was not enough to overcome the phenomenon of craving that happens once I start to drink. Nor was the knowledge that my little girl's waiting at home so her mommy can get there later that night so we can play a little bit and then get up the next day, play a little while, and then go off to work like we always did. Wasn't enough to overcome the phenomenon of craving that happens once I start to drink. And if Just Don't Drink would have worked, you'd have a different speaker tonight for sure. Because my relationship by that time with alcohol had so developed that when I wasn't drinking, it was all I could think about. And the only way I could shut up that thought was to take a drink. That's the only thing I knew that would shut it up. And I lost that. So I sat on the bar stool and I lost them both. I lost the kid and I lost the job. I lost the kid for 4.5 years. And I have to tell you that every single morning I come to or wake up and my heart would break. My heart would break every day for 4.5 years knowing that my daughter was better off where she was than with me. And I still couldn't stop drinking. Alcoholism doesn't care who you love. And so, moving on, I ended up living off the kindness of strangers. I ended up marrying my drinking partner to try to move this along a little bit. Married my drinking partner right about the time we should have split up. I kept thinking maybe if I change my circumstances, make my life look like I think yours is. You know, we got married right about the time we should have split up, and we moved indoors, and we just became the neighborhood entertainment. You know, we used to settle our arguments with a shotgun. Whoever got to the gun first won. That's how we did it. And just chaos all the time, chaos. And I got my daughter back when she was about 8.5 years old. And you'd think that somebody like me, finally making circumstances look good enough to get her daughter back, I'd straighten up and fly right. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do, right? And when I got her back, I had one job during the week, 5 days a week, one job, and that was to get in the car in the afternoon and go pick her up from school. It was a 10-minute drive each way. Go pick her up from school. And most days I'd make it, get in the car in the afternoon, go get her, come back, and I can do what I want. This particular afternoon, I got in the car and I headed on over to her school. And it occurred to me that I got thirsty. And those are three words that I know send chills down the spine of every recovered alcoholic, because we know what that means when we have no mental defense against the first drink. I got thirsty. So what did I do? I pulled into the driveway of the bar, and I bellied up to the bar, and I ordered that drink, and I started to drink. And as I drank, I thought, I'm going to have this one. I got 45 minutes, and then I'm going to go get Amber. And as I drank, I thought, maybe two at the most. Three, I'm sure I got time for three. Then somebody lines up the bar with empty shot glasses, and I can't turn down a free one, so I'm going to have four. And then I'm going to go get her. Five and six, and then I'm late. Late to go pick up the most important person in the world. And I finally peel myself off the bar stool, and I get in the car, and I head on over to her school, and now I'm drunk. And I get over to the school, and I have to go into the front office, because that's where they keep the kids whose parents can't get there in time. And as I walk into the office, the best defense is an offense, so I'm mad at the staff because I'm late. And as I go walking into the office, I trip over my own feet, and I go rolling across the floor of the office where my daughter attends school. And she's sitting across the room, and I catch her the look on her face and the look in her eye as she's watching her mom go rolling across the floor of the office where she attends school. And I felt that sense of powerlessness. And, you know, I have slid around in the street. I have been homeless. I have experienced some pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, but I don't know that I remember a moment quite like that one. Not the kind of powerlessness like, oh my God, I've got to do something, but the kind of powerlessness like, oh my God, I am never going to change. I am always going to be like this, some version of this. So the only thing I knew to do was to get up, grab her hand, and get the hell out of there before somebody called the police like they were threatening to do. And that kind of thing went on and on and on for another little over a year, until finally, one more Saturday afternoon, the cops are in the driveway one more time, the neighbors are watching us again, the kid's standing in the corner in her mismatched clothes and her unkempt hair, and she's got that look of fear in her eyes one more time. Life is blowing up around her. And I got nothing to say. How did we get here? None of us woke up saying, let's do this. We all got up that morning thinking if everybody will be cool, we'll all be all right. And the cops left, they took the gun, the husband left for the last time, it's me and the kid and the booze, and I still can't stop drinking. And here's where a hard drinker might take a look at their life and say, you know, I'm really tired of this. I've seen them do it in the bars. They say things like, oh, I couldn't control it, so I had to quit. And they do. Drink a Diet Pepsi in a bar and go back to work. But me as an alcoholic, what I did was I just pulled the booze closer to the couch so I didn't have to keep getting up to get another drink. Because I drank through my circumstances. I drank through drug addiction, and I drank through homelessness, and I drank through the loss of my daughter, and I was getting ready to do it again. And my first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with this power greater than myself, and I called it God, I still do. It's a word. It means something much different to me all these years later. But I, you know, and I didn't know if any experience that I had become a very, very vague memory, and maybe even a bare belief that I could have anything close to what I had experienced as a kid. But my first sponsor said, why don't you just start, just maybe make contact by starting to count the coincidences that have happened in your life, those situations that seem to fall together for the good of everybody without you having your hands on it. Why don't you just take a look at that for a second? Sends me into the direction of gratitude anyway. And the first thing I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she had seen and heard that whole deal go down that Saturday afternoon. And she came over a couple days later and brought me a big book and a 12-12, knocked on my door, and this time I invited her in. And she sat on my couch, and she just told me her story. She didn't talk about me or what she saw me do or any of that stuff. She talked about her and her drinking, and in her story, I heard me and mine. And what's more is as she talked, I thought about the times I'd run into her on the grounds earlier in the year, like in the parking lot or in the laundry room, and she wasn't drinking then either. And what really impressed me about that was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking, and that got my attention. I didn't know how you did that. All I knew is when I had no booze and I had no steps or fellowship or God in my understanding, I didn't really know what those were. I felt like you stripped the coating off my wires. I felt oversensitive, underloved. I didn't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my self-centered head would close in on me from there. So much so that even though I knew a little bit about booze by that time, I knew I couldn't guarantee if I was going to have 2 or 22. I knew that. I didn't know what it was called. I didn't know any of that stuff. I knew that the window of relief had gotten really, really small, 20, 30 good minutes. I also knew that I no longer had to invite trouble. It just seemed to come to visit unsolicited, doesn't it? You just open the front door and there she is again. So I didn't know how her 12 little thinly veiled Sunday school sentences were going to have any effect on me in the face of what I'd become. They just seemed a little weak, like maybe I'd tried them all before and found them wanting. So I didn't know, and I didn't get sober that night. She left, and it was about a week and a half later when I got home. My daughter was gone for about a week, visiting her dad, and I sat in that little apartment, and I didn't have any big ideas. I just sat there. And there was no more treatment left for me. People had been trying to help me all my life. And so I sat in that little apartment, and I didn't go anywhere. And I started to shake it out, and into Saturday and Sunday and into Monday. And by Tuesday afternoon, I was stark raving sober. And then I found myself standing on my neighbor's porch one more time. You know, I just, one more little cooperation with grace, you know, just shot down this wormhole of grace where I ended up on her porch asking her what to do. And she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre, California, and that became my first home group. And this, you know, when I think about this, I think about, you know, when people ask us if we're willing. If I'm doing what you just told me to do or not do, I know I'm willing. If I'm not, then there's no argument. Yes, I am. No, you're not. Yes, I am. No, you know, like, what? It's kind of like that question, will you be my temporary sponsor? I don't know. Well, I guess we'll find out, you know. Like, why bother with those questions? But I have, you know. And so I made it up to that meeting that night, and I sat way back by the open door and the exit sign just in case, And there was a lot of that chatter, a lot of that pre-meeting chatter, the music of Alcoholics Anonymous going on, people being very kind to each other and asking each other how they're doing. You know, how's that fourth step coming? Did you get a sponsor yet? Do you need a ride home? Do you need a big book? Then I heard somebody say, hey, Joe, how's your lawn? And I thought, what? I was moved a little bit, you know. I thought, you know, it just hit me like, oh my God, could my life ever be so elegant and simple as to be concerned about a lawn? My life felt so far removed from all of that. I'd see people living their lives and I couldn't look for long because mine wasn't like that. And it just touched me, you know. It was my Winchester Cathedral moment, you know what I mean? Like, I was much moved. And then the meeting, you know, and this is, I don't know what it really is, but it's a spirit, it's something with a capital S that is moving before we even take a step. There's something happening, something that was happening in that room and in me, and there was something about me receiving it and sitting there. And at the end of the meeting, the secretary asked me to read, and we read that portion. I read that portion of chapter 11 at the end, A Vision for You. And as I read, I came into the room just a little bit more, just like I do every time I say yes to something you ask me to do. Will I read? Will I lead? Will I dump the trash, stack the chairs, make the coffee? You know, all of those things. Every time. I didn't know it was a gift, you know? Say yes before you have time to think about it. You know, so many of my first time things in AA were just like holding my spiritual nose and closing my eyes and jumping, you know. And it wasn't like I didn't know how to help people when I took care of my siblings when I was young. I got all that, but I didn't relate it to anything about growing up or being, or spirituality or any of that stuff. And so, I liked what happened at that meeting, and I kept going back. I went to a lot of meetings when I first got sober, and I stayed sober for 89 days. I had a sponsor, and I was starting to read the book, but I have to say now, looking back, I had a reservation, some kind of reservation, and I'm not even sure what it was. Maybe I just didn't even trust that it was going to work, or I wasn't sure, but 89 days, and I took a drink. And as soon as I took that drink, I wanted what I'd had just a few minutes earlier, even with the discomfort. And I was lucky enough to get to come back about 24 hours later. I got to sober up, and I had to finish the drunk, but I realized that even with the discomfort, you know, I had to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And still, to this day, that's the welcome mat, right? Comfortable with being uncomfortable, that's the grow zone. You know, and I'm good with that today. But it wasn't my first thought before. And thank God when I called my sponsor and told her what happened, she didn't say, too bad for you, you had your chance, you know. Sorry. Said, I'll be there to pick you up for the big book study. And so she took me up there, and nobody there said, too bad, you have to sit outside or in the dunce chair or whatever. They said, hey, you want to come make coffee with us on Tuesday? And I thought, dang, somebody thinks I'm going to be here on Tuesday. And I came on the days in between, and yes, I came to a lot of meetings. And meetings alone do not keep me sober, but it's where I learned about steps and commitment and integrity and what this program looks like when someone's walking around with it. And I detest people saying, I don't think that one walks like they talk, because I want to know how you know. I want to know how you, I want to know, I'll talk about me. When I see someone and that goes through my head, I think, well, what do you do in the dark when nobody's looking, you know? Character's built in the dark when you can't see me, you know, when you can't, and so, anyway. What I do when you're not looking, that's what counts, and so, knowing how hard that is for me, I got to give you a little break too. And so we're all in this together. And I loved it. When I was new, I was kind of that naive. You know, I thought, yeah, let's do this, okay? And so I came to a lot of meetings, and I took the steps in earnest with my sponsor. And boy, I still, though, had some ideas that I didn't know I had. I didn't know I had to get rid of. You know, we came to that fourth step. It came time to give her my fourth step. And we're sitting there, and I was just sure that she was going to listen to it and say, well, no wonder, you know, and she didn't say that. She, you know, we talked about fear really being the chief activator of my defects of character. I become selfish when I'm afraid, dishonest when I'm afraid, self-seeking when I'm afraid of not getting enough or losing. I lie when I'm afraid. All seems to boil down to all of that. And then making amends. I wanted to make amends to my daughter. Oh my God, I had messed up her life so bad. I had been completely the exact opposite of who it was I wanted to be with her. So I was ready for her, and she wasn't quite ready for me. She was one pissed off kid, you know, for a while. But I came to a lot of meetings. And when I was about 9 months sober, I made that first round of amends to my family. When I say first round, that was when we had the talk, and I declared what I was going to do. And then the rest of the time I've spent doing that, you know, being different. And to this day, there's not one member of my family who'll stand in the doorway and say, no, please don't go to the meeting, you know, or don't go to the conference. You know, we don't care. We'll have Christmas in October. We don't care. You know, whatever you got to do. But nor does any member of my family ever have to wonder where I am or why can't they find me or don't I love them. They don't. And after that, people started asking me to sponsor them. And I got to tell you, I know no better way to say this, that the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. Because in your eyes, I see forgivability and lovability and hope and growth where I don't always see it in myself. You draw from me things I didn't know I needed to share, and you share with me things I didn't know I needed to hear. And somewhere along the line, whether it's at a formal inventory or something on the way to the meeting or over the phone or over tea, man, we have those Me Too moments and encourage each other to keep going. And on we go. After a couple of years, I'd had you guys, and my daughter had been really a good sport about all this. She'd come to meetings with me. I mean, we did, you know, we did it all kinds of ways and stuff. And you know, two steps forward, one back, one forward, three back, like that, you know. And then she started having some trouble. She was coming home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She'd been jumped into a gang. She was 11. She was in big trouble. And I realize as she gets older, she's gotten older. I don't want to tell her, you know, I don't want to talk about her whole story anymore like that, although it's on probably 5 million tapes. But she's okay. She's okay. But But she, you know, she needed big help, and so I found a treatment center for her, and we didn't know if she was addict, alcoholic, if, you know, what was going on, because she was doing all of it, and so they, she was there for 6 months, and I showed up when they asked me to, and I stayed away when they asked me to, and little by little, you know, we started to grow together, and it took from the time she was 11 till she was about 23 for us to really, really solidify our direction, you know, and to be able to come back and have some trust with each other, and I was okay with that. They told me, you know, like, don't expect the keys to the kingdom, like, tomorrow, you know, like, look, you messed up, and not that we have to, you know, crawl before anybody or, you know, wear the hair shirt, but I got to take some action. It's been said over and over. Terry said it last night, today. And when she got out, man, we had a little more trouble, a little more happiness, a little more trouble. When she was 16, she came home and she was pregnant. She had a funny look on her face, and I told her she was pregnant, and she nodded. That's kind of how we found out, And so I got to tell her, I'll be there. Whatever you need, I'm here. Whatever you decide, I'm here. And so I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson. And that kid just started his job as a working attorney just a few months ago this year. And then the youngest she had a few years later is a grown man working. He didn't want to go to school right away after he graduated high school, but he's been out working and trying to make his way too, and they're both really, really good kids, and she turned out to be a really, really great mother. And just a few years ago, I sat with my husband and my mended family, and we watched her collect her master's degree, and she became a social worker, and on the crisis impact team. Where do you think she got the training for that? On the crisis impact team with the police department. She goes in, she went into places like the Las Vegas shooting and the San Bernardino Terrorist Act and sat with the families of the victims and helped them put the pieces of their lives back together. That's who she is. And I don't know if she is who she is because or in spite of me, but I know that because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to be a privileged witness in her life and in the lives of anyone who wants to be in mine. And that's a miracle. When I was 5 years sober, you know, just going, you know, I'm going to work, took a couple of classes, you know, just showing up and doing what they're asking me to do when life goes on. When I'm 5 years sober, in the middle of the night, I wake up to a man standing over my bed. He's got a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth, and he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my little apartment. And thank God my daughter wasn't there that night. And, you know, I was a little bit stunned because I was working 12 golden steps, you know, and when I realized, like, people who didn't drink have stuff like that happen, why wouldn't it happen to me? So we go through this whole thing. He was there for a few hours that night, and at a strategic time, I tried to run for the front door, and the front door, the bolt lock wouldn't unlock, and so I got stuck, and so we ended up in a little altercation, and then after that, instead of getting more angry, he dropped the knife and he left out the same window he came in, and it turned out that I knew this guy. I'd actually watched him get sober 30 days before I did, and I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back, and then I watched him join the church and leave AA behind. And when he went out, that's what happened. And what I chose to learn from that is that, well, the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, to make use of what they offer. After all, what we have is a synthesis of what's been around for ages. That's what we have. But what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I am not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine, can't go to the church picnic and indulge in a beer. This is where I learned that. Then I can go out there and practice any kind of additional spiritual practice I want to. And I love to. You might find me at a Buddhist temple or a Sunday sermon or a Saturday synagogue. You might. But tethered to Alcoholics Anonymous, not instead of. They take spiritual principles and they talk about them in general. I'm not somebody you're going to hear say that they don't know how to do it, because a lot of people do. But what I had to learn, and what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, was my alcoholism had to be arrested before I could touch any of that stuff. So I stay tethered here, and I will never be, there will never come a day where I will be so spiritually fit that I can take a drink of alcohol in any form at all. not food form or cough medicine form or mouthwash form. So a trial followed a few months later, and as part of the defense, they had a lot of the people, the guys I'd known years before, get up and testify as to who I used to be, and you know, that was like a big public fifth step. And so we had to get a character witness for me. And you know, I guarantee you, when I first got to AA, you couldn't use Carla, the words Carla and good character in the same sentence. You know, and now it's 5 years later, and I've been showing up, and I've been improving, and I've been doing what I'm supposed to do, and taking classes, and doing tasks, and walking right alongside some very accomplished people, undetected. And so the division head at this big fancy investment firm where I was working volunteered to come and testify on my behalf, and they told him all about who I used to be, and he said, I don't know about that, he said, but she shows up early, and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. See, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he had experienced it through me. And then it was my turn to testify, and my sponsor and I had been talking about having to forgive this guy. I know that. I know what 5 years of sobriety, I don't even want a resentment, but sometimes they kind of stick to you, right? You know. And the guy had scared me. And at 5 years of sobriety, anger was still my favorite way to deal with fear like that. It feels like anger's power. Unless it becomes transformative, it sticks to me, and then I'm in trouble. So I don't want it, but I can't dismantle it on my own yet. And we have a format for that, we have instructions for that, but I still, you know, the conditions aren't complete yet, I guess. And the seven-step prayer became my mantra. It was just something, I'm not a set prayer sayer, you know, but man, that one helped me get from point A to B, all that, you know, it helped me show up for work, helped me get from here to there. And so now I'm sitting in the witness stand, and I look out and I see him, and I realize I've sat where he sat, and I realize I could sit there again. If I were to take a drink, I could be sitting in his very seat, or maybe just go crazy and end up sitting where he is, you know. And it occurred to me, those words in our four-step resentment inventory, where it says, though we didn't like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, are spiritually sick. He like me. Not, oh, forgive him from a spiritual hilltop. I hope you, son of a bitch, someday come up and live up to my standards. Too bad for you, you idiot. You know, and it's not like that. It's like me and you. Haven't I done what he's done, or something similar? Haven't I been so out of control that I've roared through the lives of others like that proverbial tornado, haven't I? Or couldn't I get so out of control that I roar through the lives of others like that proverbial tornado? Or am I right now so full of self and selfishness and just one-pointedness that I'm roaring through the lives of others like that proverbial tornado? Am I? Have I? Could I? Am I? And what happened for me at that moment was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. The forgiveness came, not of me, through me. The conditions were set, and it happened. Just like a little click. The forgiveness came. The healing took a while longer. The healing took a while longer. And even now, sometimes there are little surges. You know, stuff like that happened before I got sober, and I didn't talk to anybody about it, really. I just, you know, why? Who cared? I didn't even care. You know, and this time, what I found out was that it was for me to forgive, and it was for me to testify, that both of those could happen simultaneously. It was for me to hold him accountable. It was for me to speak up, and it was for me to forgive and not let that define me, so that my last name wasn't Carla, she was raped. You know, that these things, they serve to, we use them, we I don't know about cheerfully in the beginning, but we capitalize on those and share them. And it's been said over and over this weekend that our experience is what, when we see how our experience helps others, we heal a little bit more, every time. He was sentenced to 20 years, and he did 12, and then he did 3, and as far as I know, he's not been able to stay out of prison or sober. But I know that it works. I've had the privilege of carrying the message of AA into every place I've ever been locked up, and then to men's and women's prisons and the county jail I had a panel at for a while, and it works where it's worked, you know. The detective who worked the case came to me, and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it, because it seems to be working. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And we didn't know it at the time, but the judge had been a long, sober, recovered alcoholic. And we found out after, which I'm glad, you know. And then we found out that the court reporter was the Al-Anon mother of a woman in my home group. So the 12-step fairies had thoroughly dusted the room before we got there. My dad showed up at that trial, and my sponsor and my friends from my home group, and just friends and sponsees. And so I didn't have to go through that alone if I didn't want to. And then we went, you know, and this is like the first 6 years of my sobriety, so I don't want to scare anybody, but, you know, there was, you know, two steps forward, one back, sometimes three forward, two more forward. You know, what I know, what I have experienced is that every day I had just enough, and I didn't know it, you know, didn't always know it. I do today. I have to look for it sometimes a little harder, but every day, just enough power, just enough grace, just enough, everything I need, if I'm willing to stay here. And what helps me with that, once I came to trust the process of the first 9 steps, take care of the past, then the 10th step, for me, just me, this is my experience, how I read it, how it works for me, is at 10, I see in those paragraphs on pages 84 and 85, the whole 9 yards one more time, all 9 steps one more time. And it winds around and gives us the first one on page 85, because alcohol is a subtle foe. Why are we doing this? Because alcohol is a subtle foe. And I know what's at stake for me as an alcoholic. A lot of people are going to have a lot of bad days, but me as an alcoholic, I got to remember what's at stake. And so, not every day like, oh my God, you know. Every day like, I trust this thing. If I get up and I do what I'm supposed to do, he says this is the proper use of the will. Get up and say, what do I do now? I can't for 35 years walk around not drinking. You gave me something else to do. You gave me a sufficient substitute, this thing that crowbarred the obsession to drink alcohol out of me, so I don't have to face that first drink with no mental defense. I've got a spiritual defense. And step 10, 11, and 12, which means 1 through 12 for me, keep that spiritual cushion intact so I'm not looking at that first drink alone. So that when on a hot summer day, the waiter walks across the patio with a tray full of beer, I can say, well, that looks really good. For me, it's like drinking a can of Raid, so I'm not going to do it, but that looks pretty good, you know, and move on. I don't have to lie. I don't have to say, we don't see that. And then it's like, then I got to go through all that, you know. Ease and comfort, ease and comfort. And every day, every day I get up and my feet hit the floor and I say thank you. And I'm going to talk a little bit about amends. I got a few minutes and I do want to put this in there. And, you know, I come from a family where my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17, a couple years before she committed suicide when she was 17, just a couple years before I got sober, and it took her all weekend to die. And so while she lay on life support in a West Covina hospital, the family waited in the waiting room, and I would go out to the van where the booze was, and I'd drink, and I'd come back in, and I just raked my mother across the coals and talked to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. I don't know how you make amends for that. But little by little, my mom lived out of state. And so my sponsor said, you call her once a week and you try to find out how you might add to her life instead of take for a change. And that required a lot of listening. And my mom, you know, we had a great relationship a lot of the time, but she was sick too. And I didn't understand the more I stayed sober, there was a great divide happening, and it was weird to walk through, and I don't have time to go into all of that, but I just started to call her, and we started to get closer in sobriety, and so much so that after my brother passed away, I was about 13 years sober, and he was 30 years old, 6'10", 160 pounds, when he lay on life support in a Spokane hospital, dying of methamphetamine addiction, and he wasn't going to stop drinking, and his heart was literally disintegrating. Mercifully, when he died, I got to go up and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent, but I know that because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And when she passed away of end-stage liver disease just a few years ago, we were clean and clear. And so much so that when my stepfather, the one that worked, he was a third one, and they were together a long time, and he found out that Doug and I were together, and he said, I know you guys are walking toward matrimony. I know, so what I'd like to do, I know your mom left you her jewelry, including her wedding ring. What I'd like to do is shine mine up and give it to Doug so the rings will be together again. So those are the rings that we got married with, and my mom got to be at our wedding kind of like that. And my dad doesn't have to sit up nights anymore watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. He sleeps well, and he knows why. And over the years, you know, I'm the one that he's called when he's been diagnosed with cancer, and that's happened a couple times. And then through COVID, the pandemic, I was the one who got to bring him to the doctor and to his surgeries. And, you know, I'm the coordinator. I'm the matriarch of the family. Who knew, you know? And every day, my feet at the floor, and I say thank you, and then I go and I sit in meditation. It's important to me to make that time, to go sit quietly. You can do it almost any way you want to. Howard P., God rest his soul, and thank God he was here. He used to say, wherever you see God pass, mark that spot and go sit in that window again. And so whatever your window, whatever you call that thing, that infinite power and love, that spirit, that thing that happens inside, that makes two and two add up to five, that whatever that is for you. And we have Atheists and Alcoholics Anonymous, not a secret, and I don't know what they call it or what that, and I can't describe, if I could define my God, I'd be it. But but this thing, this ineffable thing, this big maybe, this big unknown, I feel I access by sitting quietly, asking, listening. And then I get on a phone call at 5:55 every morning a.m. Pacific time, and we gather with some friends. It's a big old conference call now, and somebody reads something, and we take turns, and then we sit together for another 22 minutes there together. And the noisiest it gets is that first 5 minutes between 5:55 and 6 a.m., and then we all shut up, meditate, and then we move on. And I'm a voracious reader. It's through the 11th step that I have realized that, you know, crazy thinking is not exclusive to alcoholics. You know, it's not. And here's something I want the newcomer to hear, because I hear this way too much, it doesn't work for me anymore, and because I read the big book, and it says that we come to rely on our intuition. We will come, our thinking will get better. I'm 35 years later, I'm not walking around going, I'm thinking, you know, there's stuff to do about that. And so I get really adamant about that, right? Because we don't have, you know, people will say, well, because I do that because I'm alcoholic. Well, you don't have to. And I'll just stick back to me. I don't have to. There's a way out. There's a way out of that. And not to, you know, not that I'm walking around with quiet mind all the time or any of that, but there's stuff to do. I fit better in my skin these days. And so my sponsor gave me a prayer, just a few years ago. I've had a few sponsors. Every sponsor has brought me to the next, and some have died, and not because of me, but but my sponsor today is Polly P., and she gave me a prayer that her sponsor gave her. She said, ask God to grant you the heart of a grateful servant. She says I remember it wrong, but I like mine better, so I guess there are two now. And God grant me the heart of a grateful servant. And when I say that prayer, I feel joy. I just feel joy. And I don't know what I'm praying to or, you know, any of that. I know I pray from God. I feel like I pray from, you know, grant me the heart of a grateful servant, and then go out and see what I can do. And I've been through big jobs, little jobs, no jobs. Now I'm had a business, then it went down with COVID, and went from childhood prostitute to massage therapist, like with all kinds of things in between, and went legit. But And then I started making art, and I'd been afraid to say I was an artist. You know, I just like, I don't know. But I'm making art. That's what I say now. I'm making art, and we'll see what happens. And my husband's just a beautiful artist, and he's encouraging. And he's the love of my life. I got to spend at least a minute on him. You know, he likes you to know he's 3 or 4 months longer sober than me. But I just tell him that he needed the head start. And he's the first face I want to see in the morning and the last face I want to see before I go to sleep. And I stole that line from that Meg Ryan and Billy Crystal movie. What was it? I forget. But the I'll Have What She's Having movie. And now we've got the dog. We're like a backwards country western song. You know, we got the house, the love, the dog, I hope I never take for granted the fact that the obsession to drink alcohol was finally lifted for me. There's not been one circumstance since I was 9 months sober where I thought that one little drink wouldn't make it a whole lot worse, where I didn't think that one little drink wouldn't make it a whole lot worse. And I hope that that happens for you soon, too. I hope that you come to trust what we have here in 1 through 9 and grow it in 10, or continue it in 10, grow it in 11, and share it in 12. And that's what we got here. That's all I got tonight. Thanks so much for having me.